According to a Gallup poll conducted just this past May, more than 9 in 10 Americans still say yes when asked the basic question, do you believe in God or a universal spirit? This is down only slightly from the 1940s when Gallup first asked the question. Interestingly, belief in God drops below 90% among younger Americans, liberals, those living in the East, those with postgraduate educations, and political independence. However, belief in God is nearly universal among Republicans and conservatives. In his latest book, The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths, Michael Shermer explores why we believe. It's published by Times Books. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. How much below 90% does belief in God drop among the younger Americans, the liberals, those living in the Northeast, and those with postgraduate degrees and political independence? Must still be pretty high if the total of all Americans is 9 in 10.
Yeah, it's still high, for sure. Depends how the question is asked. For example, the fastest growing religious group in America today are the nones, N-O-N-E-S, nones, people that tick the boxes that says they have no religion. But that doesn't mean they're atheists or agnostics. They may believe in, you know, some sort of God or power. Also, so that's just religious attitudes, but also then in just pure belief in God, what's often left off are people that have...
I think we're having a little problem with this connection, which is to a phone in Pasadena, California. Are you there, Michael? Well, I think Michael is not here right now.
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Welcome back.
I can hear you guys fine.
Oh, well, you suddenly dropped out.
Oh, okay.
I guess you must be on one of those phone systems that gets criticized in the ads.
Yeah, that's right.
No names
mentioned.
Anyway,
I don't know where I left off there, but I was saying that the fastest growing group, religious group in America today are the nones, N-O-N-E-S, people that have no religion at all. But that's different than atheism or agnosticism. That doesn't mean that they don't believe in some kind of higher power. But that's about 15 to 20% of people that have no religion at all. So that's kind of encouraging to us non-believers. In terms of how many out-and-out atheists there are, that's usually like 4 or 5%. If you throw in agnostics and deists and pantheists, and you get closer to 10%, which I know doesn't sound like a lot, but with a population of 300 million, that's 30 million people who don't believe in God in any traditional form.
Well, many of the founding fathers were deists.
That's right, absolutely.
Are all of those people who want to go back to the Constitution as the ultimate source aware of that, do you think?
They are not, no. This is one of the great myths of American history, is that modern evangelicals somehow think that the founding fathers were something like them in terms of believing in Jesus and all that. They weren't. Most of them believed in God of some kind, and they certainly used a lot of the God talk in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence as a way of establishing some kind of authority for why they could break with Great Britain and still have a society based on a rule of law of some kind. So that you kind of understand. Jefferson was probably the least religious of all of them, and he still used a lot of God talk. But the problem with all these surveys is they don't clearly define what they mean by God, and so everybody has in their own head some idea of God. So it could be somebody who follows Deepak Chopra and believes in the Great Spirit in the sky, or that quantum physics is God, or, you know, quantum entanglement and how we're all connected through the universe and the cosmos through quantum physics. That's a God. That's very different than somebody who believes in a personal being who listens to us and cares about us and has anthropomorphic-like features, psychically, I mean. And those surveys are pretty fraught with some difficulties, I think.
Well, when we say God, we're usually just thinking of the Judeo-Christian God, which also would cover Muslims, but there are all sorts of other godheads out there. And Hindus have a whole bunch of gods. So are all those people, I imagine, are also all included in the 9 out of 10. But you,
yes.
But you write also that more people believe in angels and the devil than believe in the theory of evolution.
Yes.
Paul Krugman had an op-ed piece in Today's Times in which he notes that most of the Republican presidential candidates in the 2012 race so far reject both evolution and global warming. Do you think that he is?
They tend to go hand in hand, and they tend to be lumped with conservatives. The problem here is that conservatives and people that follow them are making the mistake of thinking that the science is supposed to follow the politics, when in fact it's the other way around. But unfortunately, as I show in The Believing Brain, that's not how it works. That we form our beliefs first, usually our political beliefs, ideological attitudes, social attitudes, and so on, and then we use the science to make it fit what we already want to be true. And conservatives do that more than liberals, unfortunately, although everybody tends to do it. And so if you think that global warming and teaching evolution is going to somehow destroy the economy and ruin the morals of our children, you're going to be against it, regardless of what the science says. The science is secondary. It's irrelevant in that sense. The belief comes first, and that's, well, that's one of the reasons we exist, Skeptic Magazine, that is, that it, you know, we're trying to make the point that you don't have to give up all this stuff. You don't have to be immoral or amoral without belief in God, or teaching evolution doesn't lead to atheism and immorality and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's just a complete, total nonsense and myth. And that global warming, either the Earth is getting warmer or it's not. Either it's human-caused or it's not. This is a debate that can be resolved through more data. It shouldn't matter whether you're on the left or right to determine whether the Earth is getting warmer or not. It's just so silly that it would be so fraught with political baggage, but it is.
My guest is Michael Shermer, who is the author of Why People Believe Weird Things, The Science of Good and Evil, and 8 other books on the evolution of human beliefs and conduct. He's a monthly columnist for Scientific American and adjunct professor at Claremont Graduate University, and as he just mentioned, founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's also the editor of Skeptic.com. His latest book, The Believing Brain, is published by Times Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that, I'm quoting, although the specific percentages of belief in the supernatural and the paranormal across countries and decades vary slightly, the numbers remain fairly consistent. A majority of people hold some form of paranormal or supernatural belief. Are we talking about believing in aliens? Are we talking about God or the universal spirit?
Here I'm talking about any kind of intentional agent that lives out there or is believed to operate on some force. This could be God, this could be demons, angels, aliens, any kind of spirit or force that people believe in. What I'm arguing there, this is the chapter called Agenticity, what I call the tendency to infuse patterns with intentional agents. We take an intentional stance against other agents. We think that they're real. We assume that just like other people have intentions, that other animals have intentions, and that there's hidden forces and so forth that work there. And this is a product of what our brains do. And I derived this through a simple thought experiment. Imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago, and you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator, or is it just the wind? Well, if you think it's a dangerous predator, and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made a type 1 error, false positive, but no harm. You just become more cautious. But if you make the other kind of error, if you assume that the rustle in the grass is just the wind and it turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. And so I'm arguing there would have been a selection for, through evolution, making type 1 errors, false positives, versus making type 2 errors, false negatives. That is, our brains just assume that all rustles in the grass are dangerous predators, just in case. Now,
well, what happens to our brains when we cannot explain something to our satisfaction?
Well, we fill in the blanks. There are no gaps. Just like nature abhors a vacuum, our brain abhors a vacuum of knowledge. We just make stuff up. So, for example, what's the difference between a dangerous predator and just the wind? A wind is an inanimate force. A dangerous predator is an intentional agent. It probably intends to eat me, and this is bad. So we assume that even invisible forces, like, you know, animistic spirits of indigenous peoples, would be an example of this, that there's these hidden invisible forces behind the scenes, pulling the strings, running the show. This is what people believe. That people believe that God answers prayers and that miracles are performed all the time and so on, except for when they're not, which is often. But they only count the positive evidence, not the negative evidence. People only remember the miracles of 9/11, the people that survived. He turned left and right. It was a miracle. God directed him down the stairwell. Well, what about the people that turned right instead of left and they died? Why doesn't that count against God? So the way our brains are designed, though, is we only remember the hits, the interesting, unusual, salient things that happen that are important to us, and we forget all the background noise that becomes chance and probability, which in fact explains everything that happens.
But we're also always looking for meaningful patterns, aren't we?
That's right. So it's almost impossible to not see patterns. If you give subjects random dots or random noises in sequence, they'll find some kind of pattern there, even if it's truly random or as close to random as we can get. Our brains just don't see that. And why should our brains see randomness? There's no reason to.
Oops, we're having a problem again with the connection. You're back?
Man. Okay, how's that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know yet.
Maybe it's
I'm not sure that I think that there are some outside forces that are trying to prevent you from saying what you want to say.
It could be. How's that? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, okay. Good. So, we don't see randomness. We see patterns. Our brains are designed to just always make connections and connect the dots, and that's just the way it is. It's a good thing. Most of the time, finding patterns is good. This is how science is driven forward. This is the basis of all art and music and creativity is to find new patterns. The rub is to not think everything is a pattern, though. If you think everything is a pattern, you're probably paranoid schizophrenic, and that's not good either. So there's actually a relationship there between madness and creativity that I talk about.
Well, our brains are dependent on a multitude of subjective, personal, emotional, and psychological factors. Do postmodern suggestions of the relativism of truth affect what people believe and how they perceive things?
I think it's a problem. We had a whole issue of Skeptic magazine on why professors or why smart people believe weird things, especially professors, PhDs. The whole postmodern movement in academia, I think, was a disaster. It's the kind of thing that leads to Holocaust denial or creationism, that the idea that anybody's truth is equal to anybody else's truth and everybody should have an equal say at the table and so on. Well, you know, politically, of course, we support free speech and that everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but people are not entitled to their own facts. The facts are facts, and those can be verified and tested, and we can actually have some objectivity when it comes to facts, and those are different than opinions.
What about ESP? How many Americans believe in extrasensory perception?
Oh, it's anywhere from a half to two-thirds, depending on which particular kind, if you're talking about psychics or astrology or tarot cards or palm reading or...
I think I'm going to go to a little break. We have to go to a break anyway, and maybe we can work out the problem with the phone. My guest is Michael Shermer, who is the author of Why People Believe Weird Things, The Science of Good and Evil, and 8 other books on the evolution of human beliefs and conduct. He's also the founding publisher of Skeptic magazine, the editor of Skeptic.com. He's a monthly columnist for Scientific American and an adjunct professor at Claremont Graduate University. His latest book, The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths, it is published by Times Books. We're back with Michael Shermer, whose book, The Believing Brain, is published by Times Books. And I suspect that there are going to be a lot of people angry with you, a lot of listeners who are angry with you for some of the things you've said already and some of the things you're going to say later about alternative medicine and things like that. Does that bother you? I mean, do you get angry letters to Skeptic magazine?
Not a lot. We get critical letters, and we get letters from people that want to change our minds about different things or save my soul. I get a lot of Christians that are praying for me, which is nice, I guess. It's fine. I don't get a lot of death threats or anything like that. I think if you take the approach that we do, which is that we're respectful of other people's opinions, but we're honest. We, you know, say exactly what we think is going on with any particular claim. But you don't have to be insulting or tell people they're idiots to believe whatever they believe. That gets you nowhere anyway, so we don't do it. And so in general, that's not a problem. The bigger issue for us, I think, is, you know, just the educational system and how to shift people from reason and rationality to reason and rationality from whatever position they're in. I mean, most people feel that they're reasonable and rational and logical, and they probably are in certain domains. We just apply that process to other domains, domains of politics or religion or economics or whatever, science especially.
Well, let's talk about education for a moment. Hasn't the National Science Foundation argued that more people believe in the paranormal and pseudosciences because the state of science education in America is so poor?
Well, they do, and that is part of it, although more education by itself doesn't attenuate paranormal beliefs. It's more teaching people how to think, teaching people the scientific method, how scientists think, how to evaluate claims, how to evaluate evidence, how to, you know, sort of evaluate a claim that somebody makes, like a politician. How do you know it's true? How do we check it? You know, where are the checks and balances on claims? And that's kind of what we do. It's not so much what to think, but how to think is what we're trying to do.
Well, 70% of Americans, you say, do not understand the scientific process defined in the NSF study as grasping probability, the experimental method, and hypothesis testing. That's 7 in 10 Americans?
Yeah, that's right. They don't really learn it because the teachers don't really learn it. So I'm trying to innovate a new skeptical curriculum. I'm calling it Skeptical Studies, or in which I'm teaching a course this semester called Skepticism 101 at Chapman University. Freshman students, right off the bat, bang, I'm going to teach you how to think about things, not what to think. Everyone else in your classes will teach you what to think. I'm going to teach you how to think. Now, people claim that this is what they're doing. Professors claim they're teaching critical thinking. I don't think they are very well. I think it just gets subsumed under their larger subject matter, in which they have to cover a lot of material in class. So I'm trying to innovate a new curriculum here nationally in which we teach skepticism. You know, I mean, we already have Skeptic Magazine, and we have conferences and books and so on. The next step, I think, to spread reason and rationality is to start young. We have Junior Skeptic Magazine, for example. Start with the kids and then get them in college, and then the next generation that runs the world, they'll be better critical thinkers, hopefully.
Here's something that will rile up a portion of my audience. You write that alternative medicine is one of the pseudosciences. What kind of alternative medicines are you putting in that category?
Well, really, there's no such thing as alternative medicine. That's the term that other people use. There's just science-based medicine and everything else that hasn't been tested yet. So it's not that anybody's claim is necessarily wrong, just, you know, a priori. We don't know that. It could be that, you know, extract of seaweed causes cancer to go away. We have to test it. That's the only way to find out.
But many people complain that the people involved in allopathic medicines pretty much control everything, and so we never find out whether those alternative approaches are going to be effective.
Well, that's the claim, but in fact, it's not necessarily true. There's a lot of researchers willing and able to test these kinds of claims if we can pin them down. It's often difficult to pin down what somebody is claiming. If you go to these alternative medicine web pages, they make so many different claims, broad sweeping claims for their techniques or their medicines or whatever, that it's hard to test. So, and in science, we have to operationally define what we mean by, say, the subject getting better, the patient getting better. I mean, getting better means what? You know, lowering blood pressure, cholesterol goes down, days spent in the hospital before release. I mean, there has to be some very carefully defined measure, or else it's just my opinion versus your opinion, which gets us nowhere. And what everybody bases their beliefs on are anecdotes. You know, I heard that my, you know, Aunt Mary's cancer went away after she took extract of seaweed. Well, maybe it did, but maybe it did for some other reason that had nothing to do with the seaweed. And the only way to find out is to run some actual controlled tests in which you randomly assign patients to the control group or the experimental group, and you control for placebo effects, and the conditions are blind, so the subject doesn't know which condition they're in, and they're double blind, so the experimenter doesn't know either, so there's no experimenter bias, and so on. These things are all developed for very technical reasons to avoid bias. And even with all those measures, there's still bias in medicine, but it's the best system we have.
And people don't always want to hear that. I know a science writer who has written that vitamin supplements generally are ineffective unless you have a specific vitamin deficiency. And when she's written that, she's received an awful lot of angry letters telling her that she's in the pay of Big Pharma.
Yeah. I've been accused of being in the pay of Big Pharma, too, and I've never gotten a check. Where's my money? Of course, I've been accused of being in the pay of the
government. It's in the mail, Michael. It's in the mail.
Yeah. Well, see, the problem with that is I'm sure these people write me, too, that they have anecdotes. Like, how can you say vitamins don't work? I took this vitamin supplement, and man, my headache went away, or I, you know, my back felt or whatever. Okay, fine, but that may be good for you, but how do we know it was a vitamin enough that you sleep or you changed your diet or you started exercising more? We don't know which conditions led to you. And also, you know, the body just heals itself sometimes when you do nothing, just time. And so whatever you were doing just before you got better gets the credit, like, for example, homeopathy. Homeopathy does nothing. It's completely inert. There's not a single molecule of the homeopathic substance in these homeopathic remedies. By their own definition, they dilute it so much there's not a single molecule of whatever it is you're taking in there. So it's supposed to work by this water memory system. Anyway, but the way it really works is that people just take stuff, and over time, over the course of a few weeks or months, they get better. They get better anyway. And so because homeopathy doesn't do anything, then it gets credit for making you better, even though you got better anyway. That's what usually happens, and that's what confounds our thinking on these matters.
My guest is Michael Shermer, whose latest book is The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies. It's published by Times Books. You open your book with a reference to the X-Files and David Duchovny's character, whose slogans became a pop culture catchphrase, "I want to believe and the truth is out there." Do many viewers take those conspiracies and the X-Files seriously?
Oh, my gosh, they sure do. I mean, the X-Files writers were just going off of what's there in pop culture. All those shows, episodes in X-Files were taken, you know, ripped right out of the newspapers or web pages of what people believe. It's remarkable. But you can see the psychology at work there. That show is popular. I like the show. I mean, I wasn't supposed to like the show. All the skeptics go, "Oh, I hate that X-Files." I thought it was really well produced, and the reason I like it is because I love the mystery. Everybody loves the mystery, and the only frustrating thing for me is that actually science offers a lot more interesting mysteries than the paranormal does. I mean, the mysteries of how the universe works, how it came to be, how stars are formed, all the elements, how the brain works, consciousness, altered states of consciousness. These things are all really interesting scientific mysteries that have great potential to, like, change the world, and that's what we should be focusing on, I think.
You mentioned the pop culture. How important a role do you think media play in all of this, or these various belief systems? Are the media working hard to explore the myths, to explode the myths?
Most of the media does not do that. There's a few shows that do it, but for the most part, what the media is doing, well, part of it is the proliferation of cable channels. So the History Channel, Learning Channel, Science Channel, all the Discovery Channel shows that they have on, they have airtime to fill. They have programming that needs to be produced relatively cheaply, and all these conspiracy theories and demons and angels and UFOs and aliens and Bigfoot, all that stuff is compelling television, and so they produce it. It's not excessively produced. I know, because I'm in most of these shows. They come to my office, and I'm the token talking head skeptic at the end. And they shoot a little B-roll footage, and they buy stock footage, and they're relatively cheap to produce, and they get decent things. But what it does on a subculture set level is that people see it on TV, and they think, huh, you know, I've seen like 3 shows on these aliens or Roswell or this conspiracy. Maybe there's something to it, because I seem to kind of vaguely remember seeing a lot of this on television. That's the effect that it has. And in reality, it isn't that there's some new trend that's being exposed, like, wow, we made this incredible discovery about Roswell or aliens, whatever. No, it's that programming needs to be filled, airtime needs to be filled, and the history channel's already done Hitler to death. So, I mean, all of Hitler all the time, we've run out of that, so now they do UFOs and conspiracies or whatever, and it's just programming time.
Well, I've been to Roswell, and I didn't see anything, but locals told me that they often track UFOs.
Well, probably if they're speaking truth to anything, it's that they're tracking experimental aircraft, spy craft, things like that. I mean, that's what we know was going on in Area 51, was they were testing spy planes, the stealth bomber, for example, or the U-2 spy plane, the SR-71 Blackbird. Once these things are classified, then we hear about them. But you can imagine what it would be like if you're out in the middle of nowhere in the desert and it's dusk, you can't quite see well, you can't see really clearly, and there's this spooky-looking aircraft that goes flying by, making these remarkable turns and at high speeds. And what is one to think if you don't know anything about it? You know, then days later, you know, they're declassified, and we get to see them on TV, and there they are flying over the Rose Parade every January 1st above my house here in Pasadena. And it's like, wow, so that's what they were doing out there. It's the B-2 bomber. That's so cool. But what are they doing now that we won't hear about until 2030? And that's what people are reporting, are these, they're literally unidentified simply because the military isn't going to tell us about them until later.
In part one of your book, you quote Voltaire, "Every man is the creature of the age in which he lives. Very few are able to raise themselves above the ideas of the times." But some of the beliefs that we're talking about have existed for thousands of years, the godheads of various religions, angels, demons, spirits. Why do some beliefs persist while others disappear?
Well, some beliefs are more powerful and politically embedded. Religion, for example, has always been tied in with politics. It was initially the way that the big man, when bands and tribes began to coalesce into chieftains and states, the chiefs, sometimes they're called big men or the chiefs, justified their power through connection with the gods. That is, you have to somehow set yourself apart from the hoi polloi that you're taxing and running their lives, and you have to have some kind of supernatural power. So religions were one means, a tool, really, for political leaders to use to coalesce a group to be more politically united against another group who has their own godhead. So religion has always been in the pay of politics and vice versa. Let's be honest. You know, the history of the Catholic Church, they've put the heat on politicians as much as vice versa. So, you know, it goes both ways. And
but,
those kinds of beliefs are more deeply embedded culturally.
Well, talking about the Catholic Church, you tell the story of Dr. Francis Collins, who is the rare scientist to be nominated to lead the NIH and also be appointed by Pope Benedict XVI to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. Now, he is a serious scientist, but he also talks about the language of God. Do you think he's misguided?
Well, I like Francis Collins a lot. I think he's a smart guy. He's a classic case of somebody who's, well, it's the point of my book, The Believing Brain, is that the brain believes something first and finds reasons to justify it after the fact. And the smarter and more educated you are, the better you are able to do that. And I think Francis is really good at that. Now, he's also pretty intellectually honest. And when I pushed him on some of the issues like morality, you know, do we really need God to give us morality? Couldn't that have evolved just like the human eye did, or the human genome, which is what he believes? He believes evolution happened and that it's right there written in the genome. Well, why couldn't the genome also produce some kind of morality? I mean, we're a social primate species. We have to get along. We have to be moral with our fellow social group members, or else the group falls apart. And so when I presented him with that idea, he said, yeah, you know, I think you're right. So I find him to be intellectually honest and a really good guy who still believes in God. And, you know, let's face it, no one has the ultimate answers to some of those big questions. So it's okay to, you know, to think about different answers that people give.
We just recently lost Bud Hopkins, a wonderful painter who pretty much gave up painting, as I understand it, maybe I'm wrong, to write about extraterrestrials and human abductions. I've always wondered about people who say that they were abducted. How can we explain what they say happened to them?
Well, Yeah, I have a whole chapter on that in the book on the two different kinds of abduction experiences people have, either through recovered memories and hypnosis or through an actual experience that usually happens at night when they're asleep. So one's a sleep disorder, the other one's a product of creative imagination. Hypnosis is not a reliable method for extracting memories because it's based on the false premise that memory is like a videotape that you can rewind and play back in the theater of your mind, and if you can just get the little homunculus in there to report what he sees through verbal recounting in a hypnosis session, it seems like you're getting an accurate account of what somebody actually remembers happening. But that isn't true. That isn't what happens. Memory is a constantly edited process. So the very act of putting somebody in a so-called trance and asking them to imagine what happened, that itself is creating new memories. It just out of whole cloth, just making up stories while you're hypnotized of things that never happened. And there's a ton of really good research on this now that I cite in the book about how easy it is to convince people that of something that never happened, even kids.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Michael Shermer, author of his latest book, The Believing Brain. It is published by Times Books. He is also the editor of Skeptic.com and the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. Horticulturist Gerard Lord-Dahl joins us for our final Summer Stuff segment tomorrow. He'll tell us how to take care of our plants, indoor and outdoor, and offer advice on cleaning up storm-damaged gardens. And then filmmakers Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega discuss their documentary Better This World about two teenagers, or early people actually in their early 20s, who fell under the sway of a charismatic revolutionary. We'll also find out about the life of the legendary defense attorney Clarence Darrow. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Christina Maldonado, Sarah Waltuck, and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Angela Sheldon. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.